Philip of Macedonia. More wives, more allies. Now, there are a few glimpses of life at the royal court, mainly through the jaundiced gaze of southern Greeks, focusing on the king. Yet Philip went on campaign almost every year, so he was away at least as often as he was present. His wives did not accompany him, but stayed at home, usually either at Pella or Vergina. Both cities possessed a substantial palace, as well as other large houses, although the archaeology does not make it clear whether there was specific women's quarters occupied by the king's wives. As we have seen, most Greeks were puzzled by the rarity of slaves in Macedonia, and the royal court was no exception to this. Of course, servants can't exist where there is no slavery, and all the indications are that there were plenty of men and women employed at court. If the royal women wove clothes and supervised the running of the household, they didn't do it alone. Excavations at Vergina show that the palace was capable of mounting feasts of hundreds of guests, itself an indication of the number of staff whose work made this possible. There were doubtless cooks, sweepers, cleaners, grooms, stable hands, nurses for the children, and tutors for those who were older, maids for the king's wives, carpenters, leather workers, weavers, and other craftsmen apart from the visitors to the court, ranging from ambassadors to traders and guests and entertainers. The vast majority of the servants were freeborn, and apart from some of the specialists likely to be in Macedonians, one distinct group whose role included waiting on the king were the royal pages, the teenage sons of distinguished men sent to the court to be raised. Fosterage was a common institution in many tribal societies, and something of the sort was most likely a tradition in Macedonia. Philip drastically increased the number of pages and made the whole thing far more organized. Boys from all over his kingdom were included, perhaps as many as each of the age years of the pages. This helped integrate the aristocracies of Upper Macedonia. In one sense, the pages were hostages for their father's behavior, but they also offered a promise of future favor. They were raised to be soldiers and schooled as potential leaders. All in all, there were a lot of people in and around the court, even when the king was away on campaign, and the royal women were part of this community. Athenian women of well-to-do families lived rather secluded lives, the paleness of their skin seen as an honorable mark of how little they were exposed to the sun. They appeared in public only on certain circumstances, such as participation in state festivals. This seclusion was extreme, I'll bet for far from unique. Philip's mother, Eurydice, proved that royal women could have a public life in Macedonia, which implies that at times they were visible and politically active. Yet they did not attend the hard-drinking and raucous symposium that formed a central part of the social life of the court whenever Philip was present, for only women to appear at these events were entertainers, whether musicians, dancers, or simply straightforward prostitutes. The wearing of the veils by women was common in many Greek communities, and it is possible that the practice was followed in Macedon. Such veils varied from ones that covered most of the face to others that were more like a scarf. If Eurydice was still alive in 350 BCE, then she was surely the senior and influential woman at the court. Otherwise, there was no formal hierarchy for wives or recognized first wife. Philip married to secure alliances and father children. Sons were potential heirs, at least if they survived into their teens, while daughters could be employed in marriage alliances once they were old enough. In such circumstances, an emotional attachment to a wife was not of primary concern. This is not to say it did not ever happen. Philip was still just 25 and a man of strong passions. Although he took numerous lovers, some of whom bore him children, it is not impossible that he felt affection and even love for some or all of his wives. Scholars are determined not to assume any of the aspects of modern ideas of romantic love can sometimes forget that we are dealing with human beings. Each of Philip's wives was an individual just as he was, with a personality more or less determined, abrasive or charming. The king's attitude towards them at any time, more than anything, determined their influence. Audata, the Illyrian, was unlikely to have been a meek person. She gave Philip a daughter, Sine, who after the death of Alexander the Great would lead an army in the battle and fight at its head. She in turn had a daughter, Adea, who she trained as a warrior. It was said an Illyrian custom of some noblewomen to fight, and there's a good chance that Audata was a part of that tradition, although there is no evidence for her ever actually fighting. Given his mother's ancestry, Philip understood something of Illyrian culture and certainly did not prevent Sine from training with weapons. Phila of Elymia was a shadowy figure. She did not have any children, or at least none that lived long enough to be recorded in our sources. We don't know whether she perished young or lived on, losing prestige because of her childlessness. Those of her male relatives who joined Philip flourished throughout his reign, so there is no sign of a loss of favor as far as they were concerned. The two Thessalians gave him a child. Nicespolis of Phera had a daughter named Thessaloniki, or Victory in Thessaly, and since Philip had not won any notable engagement, there is as yet the girl was probably not born until after a few years later. Philina of Larissa bore a boy, Arithidas, later also called Philip, in 357 BCE or early 356 BCE. These are recorded children, and they may have been others who died young. Olympias from Epirus became by far the most important of Philip's wives, although according to Plutarch, her real name was Polyxena, and Olympias was just the nickname. He says that she was also sometimes called Myrtale, or Stronica. Justin says that she was called Myrtale as a little girl, but others, all sources refer to her as Olympias, and it remains the convention to use this name. There are far more stories about her than any of the other wives, because in due course she would become the mother of Alexander the Great. As he became the favored heir and then king, she became more important. After his death, Olympias was one of the main players in the bloody struggle to succeed him. At this time, she led an army, executed rivals, and was finally killed. Alexander's own self-promoted image, let alone the propaganda from the years after his death in 323 BCE, inevitably created or distorted the tales of his mother and her relationship with Philip. Plutarch says we are told that Philip, after being initiated into the mysteries of Samothrace at the same time with Olympias, he being himself a youth and she an orphan child, fell in love with her and betrothed himself to her at once with the consent of her brother, Arambas. Apart from the minor error that Arambas, which is the correct spelling, was her uncle rather than her brother, many scholars reject the whole story as romantic invention, letting Alexander's parents meet in more dramatic circumstances than simply as part of an arranged marriage. In this version, Philip fell in love with Olympias before he even saw any of the four women he took as wives before her. Their union was special because it would produce Alexander, and needed to be passionate since it was said that their love later turned into bitter hatred. All in all, it makes for a very good story, worth telling and repeating even if it's not true. The advantages of an alliance with the Melusians was obvious enough in 357 BC not to require Philip to have to fall in love. Caution is wise, although it's just possible that the pair did encounter each other and that Philip was struck by the girl. Plutarch does not say the attraction was mutual. Possibly does not mean likely, and if there was a betrothal, it would be puzzling that he waited so long to marry her and confirm the alliance. Further doubts are raised by the passage in Plutarch that follows. Plutarch claims that the night before Philip first slept with Olympias to consummate their marriage, she dreamed that there was a peal of thunder and that a thunderbolt fell upon her womb, and that thereby much fire was kindled, which broke in the flame and traveled all about, and then was extinguished. A little later, Philip, in turn, dreamed of putting a seal shaped like a lion on Olympias' womb, which his seers interpreted as a sign of pregnancy, and that she would bear a son and who was lion-like and brave. For the ancients, the conception and the birth of a man who did as much as Alexander would have been accompanied by omens. When he was born in 356 BCE, the great temple of Artemis in Ephesus in Asia burned down. The two events are unlikely to have occurred in the same day, but coincidence is close enough to be irresistible. A Greek seer explained that the goddess had been too busy bringing Alexander into the world to look after her own temple, while Persian magi despaired that the one had been born who would bring about great calamity in Asia. Hindsight is a wonderful thing, and while the accidental destruction of a famous shrine was bound to be seen as an omen, in later years it was all too easy to link things together and remember the past as it ought to have been. Philinus' son, Archonides, was probably born before Alexander. The two boys were the only legitimate sons fathered by Philip to survive long enough to appear in our sources. Both reached adulthood, but at the time no one would have known this. Many children died in infancy, and no one knew that there would be other palace princes to come. In each case, the birth enhanced the status of each mother, even if a little. To say any more is speculation, for the lives of Philip's wives and their relationships with him and each other sadly remain a mystery. It is revealing that no source records when or under what circumstances most of Philip's wives died, just as they do not tell when his mother died. None of this is unusual for Greek or Roman history. Matters improve a little under the successor dynasties established after the death of Alexander the Great, for especially under the Ptolemies, royal women played more open roles. It is not coincidence that the family culminated in Cleopatra VII, surely the most famous woman from classical antiquity. Yet even her fame is based on affairs with Julius Caesar and Mark Antony, and the sources reveal far less about her life during the years she was not with one of them. Thus, the lack of information about the women in Philip and Alexander's lives is no way exceptional, but typical for Greek and Roman history. Ancient authors concerned themselves with deeds of kings and statesmen. These left far more trace to record. Therefore, war and politics dominate the surviving accounts, which equally make it unsurprisingly that all these areas in which we know more about Philip's life. Now, the sources for this, The Politics by Aristotle, The Histories by Herodotus, Histories, 12 volumes, by Diodorus Siculus, Peloponnesian War by Thucydides, and The Lives by Plutarch, Philip and Alexander, Kings and Conquerors by Goldsworthy, History of Macedonia, Volume 1 and Volume 2 by Hammond, In the Shadow of Olympus, The Emergence of Macedonia by Borgia. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.